Okay, come guys, looks like they're not coming, so let's get started. Okay, just a reminder, the next week there's no shiur. So there's the shiur this week. Next week I'm in America. I'm not in St. Louis, I am in TAPC, I'm not in Boston, I'm not in JC, I'm not in Fresh, so I'm not in Chicago. So, other people are going. Okay, Baruch Hashem. So the beginning of Mishalach, very small, cute little crowd. The beginning of Mishalach, it's going to get really crowded in here because the MTAQs, they come in their force. It's just their first day. MTA meaning the South Africans, their first day. They're getting unpacked. But next Wednesday, this book's going to be pretty full. So, what? Where is it? Hold on to your seats. Okay. Vahi Mishalach Paro is So the Mishalachim are very, very triumphant. Or they, so we expect them to be. Very famous phrases. Uvinei Yisrael Yatzu Biyad Ramah. This is the launch of Yitzias Mitzrayim, the launch of Jewish history, the launch of Geula. A lot is happening in the beginning of Bishalach. And the parsha is very majestic and very highfalutin, and all the stories and crossing the sea and eating the man and battling Amalek and drowning Mitzrayim and Paro. Just a lot of drama in this parsha. And the parsha begins with something that seems very pre-climactic. All about the Atzmos Yosef. And everything about this little two-pasuk section is out of whack, is out of order. It doesn't fit the rest of Bishalach. So let's read it together. Vahi Bishalach Paro Sa'am, V'lo Nachem Elokim Derech Eretz Plishtim. They don't want to go through the west coast. They go a roundabout way. And then all of a sudden, Vayikach Moshe Es Atzmos Yosef Imo, Ki Hashbeh Hashbiyas B'nei Yisrael, Leymar Pakov Yifgod Elokim Eschem, Two. All of a sudden, there's this pasuk that just leaps right in. Guys, let's move up a lot. I don't want to scream. Let's move up there. Let's make it just a couple inches. What's the purpose of this pasuk about the Atzmos Yosef? The words are very pedestrian. They're very logistical. It happened in both. Historically, Moshe Rabbeinu retrieved the Atzmos Yosef when they're still on the side. If we had to tag Shalach, they're already in the desert. They're already walking through the desert on their way to the Amsa. Moshe didn't return back for the Atzmos Yosef. Moshe retrieved them, because Zal tells you he retrieved them from the Nile. But all this has happened already. So why is it written in Shalach, where it doesn't belong, where it creates a non sequitur, and a halt towards all the drama, when it should have been written in Bo, when it was historically more relevant and topically more consistent? So why is it written in Shalach? So the answer is as follows, and it's really important yourself. We're getting back to very, very important foundations of character and personality. You see, there's a lot happening that day of Tesvav Nisan. And there are millions of people who have been liberated, and they all have their donkeys carrying gold and silver and clothing. They're all worried, and they're all anxious about going to the desert. Of course, there's Pyro to deal with, and Pyro's noblemen. So Moshe is a very, very busy man that day. If you interview Moshe, say, what's on your schedule? He says, well, at 6 o'clock, I've got to check in with Paro, whether he's still on board with our leaving. And at 6:10, I've got to check in with all the Khartoumim. Maybe they're cooking something up, literally. Then at 6:20, I've got to check in with the heads of the tribes. And at 6:30, I've got to make sure the camels are all alive. He's got a lot to deal with. The last thing you imagine Moshe Rabbeinu is going to be concerned with on that day is the Atzmos Yosef. Remember, Moshe's a Levi. He's not even great. In fact, who should retrieve the Atzmos Yosef? One of Yosef's great-great-grandchildren. Those are the ones that should feel responsibility or loyalty to the great-grandfather, not Moshe Rabbeinu. And even if Moshe Rabbeinu feels loyalty, he's got an out. He's got a good excuse. I'm just really busy today. Let someone else take care of it. Let someone else retrieve and schlep and sweat. Got millions of things happening, and they all seem and feel more important than just dragging the bones of Yosef. And that's precisely the point. That's what makes Moshe such a great personality. Because he doesn't ignore simple, basic human menschlichkeit, even in the swirl of the general excitement and the euphoria and the fireworks and the redemption. There are often people in life when they're in very electric, exciting energy situations where there's a lot happening and a lot of swirl. They lose sight of individuals and they become very wrapped up in larger issues, larger, even if they're not morally improper. They don't trample on anyone. They don't abuse anyone. They don't insult anyone. Some people cross many moral lines in order to achieve their ends. And the ends never justify the means. But even people that don't act improperly, they're not attuned to individual, specific, quiet needs because they get lost. You ever find sometimes you're in a public setting And you find especially celebrities and popular people not really looking at you or talking to you. They're manning the audience, looking around, talking to you, but waving to people, or at least not waving, looking at who's around, and you just feel like a cardboard cutout. You feel like you're not there. You're not interested in talking to me. You're just looking around, talking to others, waving to others. That's just one example. Life is about starting from the ground level and being attentive to people's needs, individuals, and showing. It's called mindfulness, and it's called listening. In your day, with all this, you'll be busy. And the irony of our modern world is you're busier than we ever were. It's a paradox. Because we think that we're so much more productive. And we think that technology has relieved us from menial chores and the cleaning and cooking and agriculture. But we're busier than ever. It's called the productivity paradox. That the more that we become productive, the less productive we become. Because we just have to work harder to keep up. That's what makes city life so fast-paced. Because in cities, people feel like constantly working just to keep up. In smaller towns, people have slightly slower pace, and they don't mind working less and enjoying each other's company, enjoying friendship. So sometimes in your day, you're just so busy. Can you give a person your full attention when they're talking to you and not be there with half a mind? It's called mindfulness and being there and recognizing that when you're talking to someone, that person wants all. That's the key to being a good parent. That's the key to being a good husband. Going to come in, you'll have a lot of pressures and tensions in your day. Can you just blot it out and look? I know that very often when I'm speaking, and I'll be speaking this Shabbat, I'll be speaking next Shabbat. So very often after the lecture, there are maybe, you know, 3, 4, 5, sometimes more people that come over, ask me questions, want to talk to me about something, make a comment. And typically mincha starting, or typically other people are there, and I try very, very hard not to look through people. Not to make sure I'm recording this. Not to give people less than my full attention. And sometimes I'll sit there for 5-10 minutes talking to someone who came to talk to me, and 4 or 5 people waiting patiently to talk. But I don't feel it's right. Some of you guys are people waiting patiently not to give someone who's interested in a question or a comment or a story or to share something my full attention. It's not just about the moments you have the conflict between the two. It's also about how you prioritize in life. Sometimes you get so wrapped up with ideology and mission, and dreams, and all the things we talk about in this room, that you compromise in Derech Eretz, and Menschlichkeit, and simple things. And no one notices, just paying respect to people. And this is someone he never met. Moshe Rabbeinu never met Yosef. And the Torah emphasizes, why? Ki hashbe hashbe es b'nei Yisrael. This is not fulfilling a personal debt. This is Moshe just having sensitivity to Yosef's bones. Everyone's making a mad dash. It's a jailbreak, literally from Egypt. And Yosef's bones are going to get left behind. And he's been waiting in that coffin for 200 years, 210 years. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, I'll be the one. And he doesn't let all of his busyness get in the way of this simple responsibility to someone. And that's what makes Moshe such a hero. And that's why the Pasuk is presented in the beginning of Mishalach. It's one thing to climb up the mountain and talk to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and fast 40 days and split the sea and bring the makos and, but are you a mensch? And you just offer that menschlichkeit to people. That's the glory of Moshe Rabbeinu on this week's Parsha. And that glory of Moshe continues throughout the Parsha, throughout the story of the desert. Because the Gemara is a very interesting drasha. If you're a Tamei Mix, it means you've come into contact with a dead person. Can you enter Machaneh Levia? A Mitzara has to leave all the Machanos. Can a Tamei Mace enter Machaneh Levia? So you know how the Gemara learns that a Tamei Mace can enter Machaneh Levia? Can enter the Machaneh Shlina. But you can't enter the Machaneh Levia. Whereas it's because Moshe was effectively a Tamei Mace the entire 40 years. With rare exceptions, when he had to go into the Beis HaMikdash, he went to the Mikvah, he had Efer Par. But most, if you interviewed Moshe, if you caught Moshe on an average day in year 20 in the desert, Moshe was a Tamei Mace, and he obviously lived in Machaneh Levia. So if you're a Tamei Mace, you can live in Machaneh Levia. How do we know that Moshe was a Tamei Mace? Why was Moshe a Tamei Mace? He was a grave digger, took care of the cemetery in the desert. Now the Gemara says, source number two, even a dead body can enter Machaneh Levia. Shenemar, Vayikach Moshe, quotes our pasuk. Es atzmos Yosef imo. Imo b'mechitzasa. Which means that even after Moshe took the bones, he didn't delegate it to some pallbearers. Okay, now I took them out. I'm Moshe. I've got Har Sinai on my mind. I've got Eretz Yisrael on my mind. Here, you take care of the bones now. Moshe kept the bones. Moshe was holding the bones in his tent all 40 years. So if you just put Moshe, hey Moshe, you want to come to the base? I'm making sure, you know, Michigan, I really can't. I'm telling you, I have to wait 7 days. Because I just held Yossi's bone. I just moved him across the room because the wind was blowing. Because the rattlesnakes were too close. Whatever. I just moved the bones. Since I moved the bones, I'm Tamei Meis. So it's not just that Moshe took Yossi's bones, but he saw it as a personal, heroic act, no less than splitting the sea and no less than delivering the Torah. There's an old adage. Very important to listen. It's a little slightly different message, similar message. You want something done? You want to know the end of the adage? Or to yourself. There's another end of the adage, ask a busy person. And you think that that's counterintuitive. If the person's busy, it won't get done. But you'd be surprised. Busy people make room for additional responsibilities because they like it. They don't ask why, maybe they ask why not me. Why can't? Maybe I can do that also. Maybe I can find time for it as well. Even though I'm so busy, maybe I can get involved in this as well. Think about who represents that trait to you in your life. Who do you know that rarely says no? Even though they're the most phenomenally busy person, and they can easily excuse and say, you know what, I just can't, I'm just so busy. But they try to fit in and say, well, I can do this also, I don't want to be part of the Chevrah Kedisha, I don't want to be part of this Chas, I don't want to be part of this, I don't want to do Daf Yomi, I don't want. And this is really Moshe Rabbeinu. It's not just the high and the low, the majestic and the simple, but it's also he's really busy, but he fits it in. And ask yourself, are you someone that gives excuses for disengagement? Or you're someone that tries to battle through the static and the responsibilities and say, I want to take more. It's a better way to lead your life if you're not looking for outs. If you're looking for outs and excuses and discounts for yourself, you'll always find it. One of the interesting refrains that was always said in the Shiva of Rav Lichtenstein, his wife said it several times, he didn't give himself hanachot. Hanachot in Hebrew is a discount. It's very easy in life to justify why I can't do this and why I'm allowed to be angry and why... Because I have such a hard life, and because I have so much stress, and because everyone's an Einstein when it comes to justification. Everyone becomes brilliant. I can always trace reasons to excuse my behavior. But if you don't give yourself a discount, you say, I want to try to be the best me I can be, and try to do as much as I can and perform, you're all of a sudden you're pursuing excellence. You're not comparing yourself to other people. You're not looking to get by with mediocrity. You're not looking to acquit yourself. You're looking to engage yourself. And this is what Moshe has. Moshe Rabbeinu is A, he's not lost in the swirl of Yetzias Mitzrayim that he forgets Yosef, and B, he's so busy, but he wants to be involved in this also. And his involvement is not just, well, the exciting part of this trip are the Yam Suf and the Mitzrayim and the snakes and the Mun and the Har Sinai and the fire and the clouds. Okay, I'm carrying the bones because I feel morally responsible. I just lug them around because I'm morally responsible. But he identifies so deeply with this journey of Yosef back home that to him it's just as exciting. He gets just as excited. I remember hearing stories, and I saw this with my eyes. You know what Rav Lichtenstein would do? At every wedding, I just heard this yesterday. I went to pay, went to the Nicham Avelim by Rabbi Weintraub, and there was someone, and Rabbi Weintraub was talking about Rav Lichtenstein dancing at his wedding. Rav Lichtenstein would dance at the wedding. From the opening whistle to the final bell. Most Rosh Hashivas, not that I'm Rosh Hashiva, but myself included, I'm very mocked to dance straight through. Like sometimes I leave early because it's my rising and I got to come home earlier. But when I'm in a wedding, I don't stop dancing. I dance as much as I can. But you know how it is when the Rebbe comes in the middle, dances for a minute, then walks away. I'll be dancing and dancing and dancing and sweating and pushing. And Rav Baruch Weintraub, remember that when he was a chassan, Rav Aaron had a terrible, terrible surgery on his leg. He basically broke his hip and had a terrible, painful surgery. And Rav Baruch says, I remember Rav Baruch seeing hopping on one leg in the middle of the circle. Basically hopping. People holding him, dancing, dancing. And you know what Rav Aaron was doing when he wasn't dancing? Well, first I'll tell you what I do when I'm not dancing. I'm making a mad dash for the Shmuggy's board, getting chopped liver, sweet and sour chicken. But now Rav Aaron, he sat there and talked to the older grandparents, the entire chassan. Now, you all know that in a chasana, it's very fast-paced and very frenetic, and the kids have a lot of energy, and there's dancing and movement and marching, and who gets left in the limb? Who gets left in the loop? The older people who are trying to catch up with their cane and with their wheelchairs and with the oxygen tanks. They sit on the side, and have them everywhere. One day, you'll be with the oxygen tank or the wheelchair, the hula-hoo around the middle of the circle. And then everyone forgets about them. They're sitting in the corner because it's loud, and there's a lot of energy and excitement. You see Rav Aaron sitting in the corner talking to the Bubby, talking to the Zadie. It's about having an eye for people that may not get enough attention. It's a little bit about that also. It's just being swept up with the Sometimes I try, not always. I don't really have as boys as much as I used to because of a lot of Baruch Hashem kids and grandkids coming back and army, so I've tight windows when I can have kids coming over. But I used to have 3-4 boys every single meal, about 10, 15 years, every single meal at my table. I would wait till after davening, and then I would go around and try to invite boys who probably didn't get invitations on their own. Because naturally, some boys come, they've got more connections, they're more social, they engage with more people in the show, different camp stones, so they're invited out 30 times to Shabbos. And then some boys don't get as many invitations, and I always try to have those boys over. So it's about not losing sight of individuals in the swirl. It's about not being too busy, and it's also about having an eye for the people that don't always get the attention naturally. And if you can give them attention, so Yosef's dead. You know, he's forgotten. He's in a box. According to his eyes, at the bottom of a river, bottom of the Nile. And Moshe gets the hydraulic lift and starts diving, and the seals diving underneath trying to find the coffin of Yosef. And he's excited about it. It's not as exciting as hanging out with the cool people, hanging out with the ones that everyone want to be with, and being front row by the chassan and throwing your juggling at for everyone to see with the knives in the fire. But it's maybe a bigger mitzvah. Now let's take a look at how Chazal describes. The lo od, Ella, Shem Yaakov, Alu, Avde Paro, Vizikne Beso. When Yaakov was buried, that was a small entourage. Who accompanied Yaakov back to Israel and Rechi? Yosef, the brothers, a couple Egyptian representatives. Be'im Yosef, source number Gimel, the end of line one, Be'im Yosef, who accompanied Yosef to Eretz Yisrael? Ha'aron, v'ha'shchina, v'ha'kohanim, v'ha'levim, v'chol Yisrael, v'shiva nani akavo. Wow, what an entourage accompanying Yosef's burial. His levaya had Jews and Kohen and Levi. Are you out of your mind? These elements weren't accompanying Yosef's burial. These were the Jewish people marching through the desert, going home. Yosef was just tagging along. Yosef was taking a trip. This procession wasn't about Yosef. This procession was about the Jews marching in Israel. The Alan HaKavod and the Shechina and the Aron. But for one person, it was about Yosef. And who was that person? And in Moshe's mind, this procession was just about, just as much about Yosef as it was about Jewish people and history and glory. It's such an important trait. It's so grounding in life. Who isn't getting the attention? Make them feel special. Don't get lost in this world. You're walking to a wedding. When's the last time you walked into a place where there's just a lot of energy? And you felt a real excitement. And you wanted to speak to as many people as you could. And you wanted to make the rounds. And you felt your heart racing and pumping. Slow it down. So you won't say hello to everyone. Say hello to 2 or 3 people. But you'll give them your all. You'll give them real attention. Right? When I was walking here, I was just like flipping through my Twitter feed. And some person asked on his Twitter, who would you want to follow you on Twitter if you could choose someone? No one was saying celebrities, Kobe Bryant, with sad face, whatever. I asked that question, like, why would I care? Like, I don't feel better if someone follows me or worse if someone follows me. It's not who I am. It's not my self-esteem. How many people have to like me or not like me? You know, like, and that people like, why would you even answer that question? What do I want to follow me? Myself? I don't know. I follow myself. I don't process that. So it's a beautiful preface to Moshe. It's not about the spiritual strength. It's just about being a mensch, slowing it down, paying attention to people, mindfulness, petty things, not necessarily grand things, even though you're busy, engaging in it emotionally, not delegating it to other people. Try not to delegate in life. Do as much as you can on your own. Remember, in this room, we almost got into a fist fight with Rav Aaron. Why did we almost get into a fist fight with Rav Aaron? Because he wouldn't let us carry his svarim back to the base match. And we'd be pulling and he'd be pulling. I'm obviously dramatizing it. We'd be pulling. He wouldn't let us. Because you're healthier that way. You're healthier not delegating. So what doesn't delegate? Oh, too busy. I feel very awkward sometimes. Sometimes I'm just rushing, and I don't want svarim of the base match to be outside of the shelves, but I literally don't have a second to walk up and I just have to go. So let's come over here, put the safer back. I just feel... Now, I'm torn between the two. On the one hand, it's good conscience to put svarim back. The makom should be clean. It's good for other people to see that I'll just take svarim and let them stay in my makom and try to put them back in a timely fashion. On the other hand, I don't want to give any responsibilities to anyone else. I'm running to get somebody from the office. Can you get cheap? Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't delegate. Moshe Rabbeinu carries the bones. And if Moshe doesn't delegate, kol v'chomer. So you have to delegate, obviously. But okay, so that's one message tonight. Another important message, really, really crucial message. Rav Amital's famous story about Dama ben Nissi. So let's start with Mara. Mara is training wheels. Mara is the chance for the Jews to train about religion. They're not chayiv yet, they're not commanded. Come on, let's put it into football terms. Exhibition season. They're playing exhibition games. They don't count. Try on some mitzvahs for size. Who's going to be the quarterback? Well, throw him out there. Let's see how he plays with the second team. Not true. Throw him out there. This is exhibition season in Mara. So you want to draw up a couple of plays during exhibition games to see whether the quarterback can throw, whether he can run, whether he throws interceptions. You don't just throw in any plays. You design your plays very carefully. So what plays does Hashem design for exhibition season? What are the mitzvahs he delivers in Mara? So the pasuk tells us, Shem, Samlo, Choku Mishpat, Hashem Nisa. Chok u'mishpat, that's interesting. Typically, although chok means many things in Tanakh, but the classic association is that chok is irrational, mishpat is rational. So it sounds as if this was a mixed bag. Rational, non-rational. So what does Rashi say? Rashi quotes the Medrash. Sham samlo bimara nasam lehem mixes parshiel sheltar. She's asking him. Shabbos, paraduma, argir says paraduma, payalaf. Bedina. Now, which of these doesn't make sense? Easy. Shabbos makes a lot of sense. Once a week, it's iconic, creation, Jewish belief, belonging. Gerim today, when Gerim are practicing, one of the ways they practice is Shabbos. Now, they don't keep Shabbos fully because they're still Ger, they're not a good Ger yet, they're good, so they're doing Malacha, they like that, but basically the Shabbos experience is extremely embracing and extremely orienting. Shabbos is obvious. Dinim, morality, social conscience, building a society of ethics and protecting the rights of the weak. No brainer. That's what one of the purposes of Judaism is, to create a better world, not just the other world, but even on this world. So we want to create a better world where we can function, play nice in the sandbox, respect law. But paraduma? That's a bizarre mitzvah to test out. Paraduma, they don't have a mishkan yet. They can't even process the paraduma. All they can do is study in theory. Shabbos they can keep, and they kept it in Mara. Even they can start to set up courts, and it sounds like they did in Parshas Yisro, even before Har Sinai, to adjudicate, to answer, to resolve differences. Paraduma, they can't even execute. There's no mishkan. And they don't need to execute it because there's no tumah. Tumah is a halachic state. It's not a real mitzvah. I can touch a dead body. I'm not tamei. I could be bearing a mace mitzvah. I'm doing the best mitzvah in the world. I'm the spiritually most kaddish person. No, I'm just tamei. Be careful. People misunderstand that. When we talk about a woman who's an eidah, she's tamei. So the English translation is impure. But that carries very negative connotations. She's not an impure person. It's one of the most beautiful moments of a woman's life. It's a reproductive cycle. Not impure. In fact, if a woman doesn't have eidahs, then there are medical issues, and she may not be able to have children. It's really a dysfunction or a limitation. So when we say that she's tummy, I can be tummy. We're all tummy. We've all touched dead bodies for good reason. So tummy is nothing bad with being tummy. It's purely a halachic state. And they don't have halacha yet, so no paraduma. And most importantly, it doesn't make sense. So why deliver a mitzvah that they can't understand? It's hard enough to be commanded towards a mitzvah you don't understand, let alone pre-commandment, think about a mitzvah you can't understand. How is this going to teach them about religion? Shabbos is a gateway to so many deep ideas. Dinim is a gateway to so many deep ideas of morality, ethics, society, paraduma. So to answer this question, Rav Amital told us the story in Kiddushin of Dama ben Nissi. Famous, famous story. I'll paraphrase. Beautiful, one of Rav Amital's probably most famous vats. I'll tell you another Rav Amital Bart for next week, Yisrael, just because I won't be here. I'll tell you two Rav Amital Barts then this year. Dama ben Nissina was a Gentile living in Ashkelon. Let's paraphrase the Gemara. And one year, Dama ben Nissina came about some precious gems that were necessary for the Avnei Ha'ifuk. There were two types of gems. There were the gems that were in the Choshen. Those are small gemstones, 12. Those are huge rocks. on the shoulders of the Kohen Gadol, attached to the straps of the ephod. You can imagine those are pretty pricey. Not just some gems you'd get on eBay. They're pretty pricey. So the Chachamim came visiting Dama ben Nesina. And they were willing to fork over a small fortune. Problem is, you all heard the story, Dama ben Nesina's father was sleeping on the key to open the safe that housed the gems. And Dama ben Nesina had such incredible kibud avraham that he didn't wake his father. So first of all, I speak in the name of all the fathers in the world. Please don't listen to this gemara if it happens at home. I tell my kids, if someone comes by, they want to, you know, give me $1 million and I happen to be sleeping, please wake me up, water, tickle my toes. Like, when we don't hear in the story, we don't hear Dama ben Nesina's father's reaction. What are you crazy? I can sleep it off and wake me up. Like, Dama ben Nesina got whipped and docked and punished and I can't go out with your friend. What are you thinking about? Why did you come so from? Is that you the ghost? You come back so from? Crazy. Anyway, so the Gemara is holding this out as a highlight, as a showcase for Kibbutz Avraham. And you may not know the end of the Gemara, because the end of the Gemara is fascinating. Here's where it gets really interesting. What was Dama ben Nesina's schar for forgoing the wealth that was coming to him from the ephod?
His cows gave up to him.
Right. So what happens? Now the Chachamim come back next year. And now they really have to extend the contract. Now it's not just a franchise tag or a veteran minimum contract. Now they're paying the king. Now they're really paying. For the stones, maybe $1 million. For the paradigm, it's $10 million. Easy. So now they're ready to give over more money, fork over more money for the paradigm. And now here's the punchline. Dama says, you know what? Don't pay me paradigm value. Pay me the money I forfeited last year for the Avnei Shalom. Give me that money. What's he saying? What's the message here? I don't want paradigm money. I want Avnei Shalom. Or saying differently, I don't want paradum money, I want kibud avraham money. Last year I lost $1 million because of kibud avraham. That money I deserve. The paraduma money, the higher bracket, not mine. Why not? So Rangfeld said something really fascinating. Kibud avraham is logical. No mitzvah more logical. It's hard, it's challenging, it's logical. Your parents raised you. As you're older, you realize how much they invested in you, how hard they worked. So when you're young, you take things for granted. You get older, you realize how fragile it is. Society is only strong if it's built on the backbone of family values. That's why communism fell. One of the reasons it fell is it tried to create a firm society without family units. The kids out of a family, raising the communes. Reminds you of Kadosh Baruch Hu, who's your father. So many reasons for keeping away. Paraduma is the quintessential hook. There's no way in the world to decipher why ashes of a red heifer burned on a particular mountain, prepared in water, sprinkled by a particular person at a particular time on day 3 and 7 should alleviate death and turmoil of death. But that's the whole point. There are parts of life and religion we can't understand and we have to defer to Hashem. Why do you think the quintessential chol alleviates death? Because we don't have answers for death. When it comes to us facing death and a period of death, Hashem has to sweep in with the illogical parts and say, solve it for us. How do we solve death? We can't solve death. So Hashem has to do it for us. How do we solve contact with death? We can't. So Hashem creates a mechanism we can't understand because we can't understand death. And paradigm is not just illogical, but it's an enigma wrapped in a riddle because it's not just it doesn't make sense, but it's counterintuitive because all the people who process paradigm become tummy. So it's an inverted pretzel. Not only is it illogical, but it's anti-logical. Because you're taller, but I'm tummy, because I'm sprinkling it on you. And for us, religion is a blend of the parts we can understand and the parts we can't understand. And that is one of the pressure points that makes religion so challenging in the modern world. We've become hyper-empirical. We've become slaves to science. We've become slaves to self-mediation. I only trust what I can prove. Give me the equation. Give me the algorithm. What role does irrationality play in your life? I want to talk about Kabbalah now, but what role are you willing to accept ideas you can't understand because they've been delivered to you by others rather than being self-mediated? Are you willing to accept realities that you can't prove and in theory can't even be proven? Or are you stuck just in that small space of provability, empiricism, cognition that my brain can compute? It's very safe, but it's very, very limiting. And religion is not. Can I prove to you Har Sinai? I don't think anyone can prove Har Sinai to anyone. It's a leap of faith. And once you take that leap of faith, everything makes sense, because I'm not claiming that a prophet told me anything and translating that into a religion. I'm not claiming that a person walked, claiming that Hashem spoke to us directly. Panim mo panim. I can't prove it, but once you take a leap of faith, it all falls into place. So that's trust, it's belief, it's passion, it's intuition. So Sapara Dhamma reminds us that the Rashan can't conquer all. Rashan can't explain all. And Dhamma ben Asima could not fathom that. In his mind, religion, as it is for most Gentile religions, is purely rational. So Dhamma ben Asima is saying, I'm an honest guy. I understand Kibbutz of Aim. I'm willing to make money for my dedication to Kibbutz of Aim, money I lost last year. But I'm not willing to take money for Paradigma, because in my world, Paradigma doesn't make sense. And Paradigma, like experiences, I'm an honest person. I don't deserve money for something that I just don't agree with or can't incorporate. So if you ask me, I believe in keeping it open, so I serve keeping it open, I deserve to be paid for that. But I don't deserve Paradigma money, and he's an honest broker. What makes Judaism so powerful is these two pistons, these two poles. And that's why Mar Hashem says, take two types of mitzvahs. I want you to practice the rational mitzvahs, social, Shabbos. I also want you to practice performing something you can't understand. Because it's training us to be religious. Hashem has to provide the full training. And that's why it's so crucial. You know, it doesn't make sense specifically because it doesn't make sense. At Mar. It's something we've talked about a lot. It's a bit of a transition. That's what faith is based upon. It's not just in halacha. There are times you don't understand halacha. I imagine for most of you, maybe not. Maybe your world is over-sexualized to the point that you appreciate what negiah this or negiah is and this or you kind of thing. We're getting to the point where there's a bit of a repulsion to how over-sexualized our society is and a recognition of the healthy sexuality that's governed and regulated by yichud, by negiah. I mean, this is going to be hard for you. Rishon in a couple of years, you're going to get married. I mean, it's really hard. There are times that, especially again, I don't want to introduce you to things that you'll learn about, that you have to be physically separated from your wife for significant periods of time. And then as you grow older, you realize, well, that makes the marriage real, and I can communicate, not just touch, and I can talk to someone. It gives it skills and buoyancy to the marriage. So you won't always understand halacha at every stage, and you won't always understand life at every stage. Who knows what will happen to your life? You can't make sense of everything that happens. Why is Hashem doing this? Why is Hashem? But faith transcends, right? Think of faith as a relationship. Right? What's the deepest relationship that you have? Are your parents? Are you a really good friend? Some of you may have a girlfriend. Just there's a level to the relationship that you trust that person, and you're able to labor on even though parts of the relationship just don't make sense to you at every moment. You don't solve it all rationally. And that's reality. That's a level of existence that's deeper than rational. And so it's true about religion. And this was Rav Amital's description of the Dhamma ben Asima story, overlaid to the Mara practice session. And Rav Amital wrapped it all up into the pasuk we say every day in davening, Chukav Mishpatav Yisrael. We received Chok and Mishpat, Chukav Mishpatav Yisrael. Lo Asachem Lechogai Mishpatim Vaidor. Hashem doesn't deliver that package to everyone. There's some religions that are hyper-rational and some religions that are hyper-mystical, but Judaism is right. We ask people, like, what does it mean to be a Jew? Are you empirical and rational or are you mystical? It's a hard question. We really are rationalists. We are scientists. We are people of concrete realities. We're not just lost in some kimbayu, some world of mystical. We really are grounded. And on the other hand, there's a mystical world, and we believe in ideas that we can't prove and pass it on to us. That's what creates buoyancy and heft in life and the ability to handle both. That's why they were given both. Let me just take a few minutes to share the Yisra Rav Amital story, because it's a little bit related to the Shalach. I told you last week. I told you 2 weeks ago, okay, in Veira, with the Rebbe and the cow, and the cow, and the cow. Okay, so I told you that story already, so I don't have to say it again. Okay. Let's just take a look at... Let's talk a little bit about... what should we talk about here? Okay, let's talk about number three. Number three is important because it talks about what role the Rebbe should play, and it's something we're very conscious of. But it also implies what role the Talmud should play. What I mean is as follows. But Yehovah Moshe El Yoshua, we saw Moshe, the portrait of Moshe in the beginning of Moshe, and his heroism in dealing with the Asmat Yosef. Now it's the end of the parasha. Moshe has to wage war with Amalek. He asks Yeshua for assistance. But listen to the phrase he uses. He says, Bechar lanu anashim. Go choose people for us. Bechar lanu anashim. That's strange. What should Moshe really say? Not Bechar lanu anashim. Bechar li anashim. I'm coordinating. I'm going up to the mountain. I'm in charge. I'm delegating it to you, but I expect you to find people to be under my service through your agency. Why is Bechar lanu anashim? Elie Weber has a story he always tells. And I think he told it in Tzfat. We went to Reb Lichtenstein when he turned 40 or so, or after 40. And he asked, said, Rebbe, now that I'm 40 or past 40, maybe I should cover the parts of the Ramban that are Alpi Kabbalah. Because in many Rambans, he'll get to the end of his rational session, his exegetical session, and then he'll launch into a Kabbalistic section, and most of us skip it. So it wasn't just what Rav Aaron said, but how he said it. He said, those parts of Kabbalah that Ramban writes about, they're not meant for people like you and me. And Elie was just flabbergasted. He said, in what universe are you and me in the same sense? I didn't say that. That's how Rav Aaron saw it. It was a shared experience. And so made Rav Aaron so compelling to us that we once asked him what we should learn for Bikias. Like, should we learn Bikias, Ian? So he got to the point where we started talking about Bikias and Ian. He said, Rebbe, can you define Bikias for us? It's just a Bikias, it's Gemara, Rashi, Tosos, the Rif, the Rosh, the Rifa, Bikias. So he said, someone raised his hand and said, Rebbe, that's Bikias, you'll never finish us that way. So he looked at us, and there's a totally innocent look. He said, I did. And there was no guide in that moment. He was just saying, I'm no different than you, I'm not special. If I could do it, you could do it. It wasn't a guy going in and saying, oh, I did it, now you have to catch up with me. He said, it was very innocent, I did. And this is what you see in Moshe's anivos. Part of anivos is internal. Part of anivos, or part of anava, is creating what I call shared experience. A sense of an equal playing field, a sense of equality, rather than hierarchy, rather than authority. And I think about this a lot in education, because in our yeshiva, we are creating space for you. And we do want you to grow a little bit more on your own. And a little more, I was speaking to someone that visited the yeshiva for a couple of days, an adult. And he was just flabbergasted. He was just shy. He said, everyone here is so different. One's serious, and one's very driven, and one's very mature. I've never been in a yeshiva where they're so different. I'm just used to a yeshiva. Everyone's the same when it's homogeneity. And he was saying it in a very, very complimentary form, that people can be different. And the way to make people great is to sustain your differences rather than collapse them into one model and one cookie cutter. Who are you and who are you? And how could you find that unique blend of how HaKadosh Baruch Hu made you and then generate real Avodas Hashem? But that means the rabbis have to create this sense of, you see, when you instruct someone, there are two ways to instruct them. Because in the end, I am delivering. We are delivering to you a set of values that we want you to submit to. So at the core of instruction, of religious instruction, is submission, where there's no... The ticket of entry to Yeshiva Har Zion is Avodas Hashem. Number one, I'm going to conduct a lot of interviews now. Voices, I love learning, and I love... But I don't really feel like I want to be an Avodas Hashem. I hope he didn't say that. And I have rejected words because I just didn't feel like they knew what it was. No one ever told me that, but I just felt like he just doesn't know what it is. He's here to improve his skills, he's here to learn more, but there's no inner drive to being a better Avodas Hashem. So you are here to submit, but I can take the full weight of our Masar, land it on your head, and say, this is what you have to succumb to. And then watch yourself just shrink. And then there's very little you left. Or you can somehow try to take this Masar and say, here it is, and then rise and carry it. And be a bigger person. And carry it in your way. And you can feel it. In any educational setting, whether it's a Rebbe in a Talmud, or whether it's a father and a child, you want to build character. Are you a better person when you come out of yeshiva? Has Avodas Hashem made you a better person, a deeper person, a stronger person? I don't mean physical strength. Or have you shriveled because you've abdicated whom you are? And that's the type of chinuch we try to pursue here. And that's what Moshe had with Yeshua, Bechar lanu. He gave him a sense of shared experience. I think it's so crucial in yeshiva, the rebbes don't sit up front. I don't know of yeshiva, but in a lot of yeshivas, the rebbes sit all in the front, and everyone's looking at the rebbes, and I understand that I'm not critiquing it. But we're trying to accomplish something different here. Like we spread, first of all, we can eavesdrop on you more easily. So you sort of hear conversations going on and think, you don't know what we're listening to. We've got bugs placed strategically all over the place. We can listen to the conversation. No, but seriously, we don't want there to be this distance. And we're the authority figures, and you have to succumb to us, and it's just, let's learn together. Let's grow together. Today the boys asked me after the Shir Dalai boys asked me, in 6-7 years, when Mirta Shem, when you give Baba Basra again, are you going to use the same Makaras sheet? Because I omitted a couple of Makaras, same way to add the Makaras. I said, yeah, I use the basic shell, but I really work hard every Shir. I really go through the Sigi again. I don't want to pull that out of the freezer. Every once in a while, when I have enough on a plane, I pull the Shir out of the freezer. But part of it is not just because I want the Shir to be fresh, but I want the Talmudim to get that sense that I'm not just standing there, okay, you guys prepare, I'll come in 2 minutes before Zayda and give you Shir. But that they're working in the base manager to crack this again. And I'm working in the base manager really hard to crack this again at my level. And so now we'll meet at some intermediary level. But then I'm working also on this again. I'm trying to say Baba Bas also. And it's hard for me to get up in the morning also for davening. And I'm working on meet us also. It's not just, because that's when you sense authenticity. Oh, the Rebbe's up there talking, do this, do this, do that. No, and this is only a mirror. This is what I really want to become. So I'm in a different stage of that journey, I'm a different stage of that trajectory, but it's the same overall process. How can I develop the mitos that you try to work on? How can I develop the friendship that you try to work on? How can I become a better Obed Hashem? And that's what Moshe has with Yeshua. And you hear Chazal translating. Look at Avos Reb Nosson, for example, source number Gimel, 3 Gimel. Eblezer and Shemur, Yihi Kavod Tamitcha, Chavi Balacha Kishocha. What does it mean you have to honor him? Typically, Chazal say he covered Chavercha Chavalacha, he covered Rabcha Chavalacha, he covered Talmidcha. Doesn't mean I have to honor you. I have to honor you. I have no mitzvah to honor you. But I have to honor the you. I have to honor the individual. I have to respect the individual. I have to know that there's a person there. And as much as I try to change you and inspire you, it can't come at the cost of you. There's that you inside. I try to passion, values, advice, guidance, role modeling. But who are you? So, you know how many times people ask me for you know, advice, and I try to give advice, but I try to stop the same as what you have to do. Because it's that level of invasion that I just don't feel comfortable with. I strongly believe, and once in a while I'll feel the boy needs more direct and absolute, maybe take the decision, what should I do, should I go here for the summer, here for the summer. But in the end, it has to be your decision. I can balance out the decision, allocate proper weight, say you're missing certain factors, you're putting too much weight in a certain factor. In the end, it has to be your decision. That's what Kavatamit is. Now, if you flip the equation, here's where you sit in. You have to use that to your advantage, not to your disadvantage. How do you use it to your disadvantage? Well, the Rebbe is not really imposing, and therefore, I don't have to show up. Okay, that's a very, very gross violation of the contract, because we're trying to get boys who know this. Of course you show up. Of course you work hard to be engaged, because we're here for you. We're not here to keep scheduling and attendance is all high school. Well, you have to, or else the framework will fall apart. There's many different levels of services. But here, of course, you want to be involved as much as possible. You want to engage as much as possible. What messages should I take from the Rebbe? Sometimes it's harder to translate the messages here. When I give this year, okay, and when I give my Mercer in Yeshiva, I'm very, very sensitive to the fact that I want the messages to be as grounded as possible. Not talking about philosophy and hashkafa and Eretz Yisrael, I'll put on it from time to time. But how to grow as a person, how to be a better person. But I've had people from other places, I mean Sheldon or Hakovan, other, and they say, you're not direct enough. You have to tell the boys. I'm sure there's certain muscles you've heard with the Rebbe Magnus, you have to be this, you have to do this, So that's easier to respond to if you like it because it's very direct. You have to be exactly like this and dress exactly like this and think exactly. But don't allow this muscle to become too general. And don't shoot the arrow, then draw the target. Oh, the Rebbe must have meant this because that's what I wanted him to say. It's easier for me to absorb that message. Now, if there are messages that challenge you, don't run away from them or reframe them or recast them in ways that are more accommodating to your current situation. Challenge yourself. And that's really on you, because we do respect you and we're not indoctrinating you. We're not mind-bending. We're not playing manipulative games. We're not trying to get you to think one way. We're going to try to respect you. And the truth is, it's very powerful. You don't realize it. I don't know it, nor do I care Brother Yeshua, if I told you, I'm thinking a lot about this in the last month, about what that woman told me in Tzvati, that woman in the hotel. She couldn't stop gushing or bursting the whole time. She was like, one time she saw me, she pulled me over and said, I've never seen a group like this. I've never seen a group. And you know, I'm a very harsh critic of our yeshiva, not in bad ways. I want to try to make us better. Like, you can't be better unless you're honest. What do we do right? What do we do wrong? Own it. There's a mistake. How can we change? What do we not do enough of? If you're not thinking about that in life, about yourself and your organization, you're stuck in neutral. You're stuck in that neutral place in the apathy. You always win. Well, basketball, I know football's over, so I know all the sports fans here, no basketball metaphor. You'll win 40, 50 games a year, but you're not making it out of the second round. You can be stuck in purgatory. You always win in a lot of games, what? Were your team stuck there?
No, they got them. I
did. I don't know. You're going to be stuck in playoff purgatory. You win 45 games a year, but you don't make it out of the second round. Because you don't really ask, you've got a team that's good enough to win a lot of games, but it's easy to be successful. But how you become phenomenal, you got to be honest. With the players on the team, they'd be popular, they'd be very talented, but got traded. As they get to the championship, we just need to get rid of that piece or add another piece. Same thing in life. It's easy to be good. It's hard to be phenomenal. To be phenomenal, you have to be very, very exacting and unforgiving and honest and cutthroat almost with yourself. I try to be that with yeshiva. If I just locked in the yeshiva of 1985 or 1993 for you guys, I mean, very strange yeshiva, very strange haircuts. But aside from the interviews, your Rebbe, me, Rav Friedman, Ellie, we're that first generation of Talmidim of Gush version 1, and to make Gush version 2 or version 3, we said, well, what does yeshiva have naturally in its DNA, and what can we add to the yeshiva that we didn't receive as Talmidim? It was hard for us to look back at our own experiences and critique ourselves. So you have to perform that also. It's always more pleasant to be given more space and not to be accountable and not to be in high school anymore. And I think that's how you grow up as people. I think that you're just very mature. Don't take that for granted. It's a very mature environment. Kids are acting mature. It's not high school. It's not grade 13. You walk in and you're with adults. You're expected to act like adults. No one's running around, screaming, throwing. It's just, you're acting in an adult world, as far as I know. So right now you are throwing food. It's a very adult world, but just make sure that there's this thirst for growth and challenge yourself. And don't let the year or 2 years occur with too much space for your own growth and too much respect. I mean, everybody respects me, therefore he translates respect into expect. He respects me, therefore he expects certain things from me. And am I living up to expectations? Am I living up to expectations? Okay, let's stop here. Bokeh tov. Let's go to Maariv. You can't imagine how happy I am when I sleep in this year. It's all good. Bokeh tov.
The emotion of the last mitzvah himself. How does it?